This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're with the Morning Run, Julian Shouning and Sharitz with you. We got a poll running. The new public service vehicle, or PSV, regulations will kick in on July the 12th. Are you concerned that e-hailing fares will increase as a result? So head on to BFM Radio on your Twitter and tell us why. Now, this Friday is also the deadline for e-hailing drivers to obtain a public service vehicle license as required by the Ministry of Transport. So far, we know that from Anthony Look, the Transport Minister, saying that at least 10,000 drivers have passed and obtained the license. This is out of over 16,000 applicants, so the passing rate is about 62%.
Yeah, and however, it is estimated that there are about 200,000 e-hailing drivers around. That would mean only 10% drivers have so far applied to sit for the test. But it's worth to note that at the moment on the road, there are about 60 to 70,000 taxi drivers on top of the those who are currently undertaking the PSV license.
This PSV license is also applicable for taxi drivers, right? So
That's right. In order
to get this license, drivers must, among other things, attend a six-hour training course and pass an exam which costs 200 ringgit, undergo a medical examination, and then take their cars at Puspacom if they're more than 3 years old. Now, many drivers say that the process is burdensome and the three-month period given to comply with the requirements was unrealistic. So it's far too few e-hailing drivers obtain this license, we may see the number of drivers on Grab and other platforms fall, which also means longer waiting times and higher fares for consumers like us.
Now, Ideas actually came out with a report sometime last year, again, to look into detail about how these rules will affect the e-hailing industry. And we actually have Lawrence Todd, who's Head of Research and Development of Ideas, which is the Institute of Democracy and Economic Affairs, on the line. Good morning, Lawrence, and thanks for joining us. So these rules, how do they compare with some of the recommendations that you made in your report sometime last year?
Well, look, I mean, I think the overall point is to say two things. So I think that the first thing is that I think it's important that we welcome the fact that the government is regulating, because the approach that a lot of countries actually took is to outright ban e-hailing. Whereas what this government did is they recognized that the e-hailing is making an important contribution in Malaysia, both on the employment side, but also in kind of easing the challenges around public transport. And so they wanted to give it, you know, a kind of valid legal framework. And they also recognize that there's a real need in terms of improving security for drivers and passengers. So I think, you know, the first thing to say is that, you know, we should welcome the fact that the government wants to regulate and put an effective framework in place. The question then is, what are the details? You know, and I think that the big mistake at a headline level is that what the government has done is relied too heavily on taking the framework that existed for taxis and just sort of copying and paste that across to e-hailing, when actually these are quite different business models. A lot has changed since the rules that we invented for taxis back in the 60s and 70s. You know, a lot it's very different now when we look at what actually e-hailing needs in terms of effective regulation.
Lawrence, this feels like a kind of non-tariff barrier because, for example, the requirement to get a PSV license is very prohibitive, very crippling to either the cost and time of the users. Do you think that this will, it's a very big negative for the e-hailing industry?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good example. So if you take, you know, for example, the requirement that, you know, you have to go and comply with quite an onerous driving test, which is something that's existed for tax drivers for a long time. And, you know, just to take a moment to think about why that has been the case, it's because in the 1970s, to be a taxi driver, you needed to sort of demonstrate that you had good geographic knowledge of the city, for example. But actually, that's really changed. I mean, who doesn't drive with GPS now? So actually, is this still a relevant requirement in 2019? When we're talking about e-hailing. So that's one example. I mean, I think the government has made some slight modifications and simplified some of the requirements since we published that report. But I still think that there are ways that could be further simplified. You know, for example, one thing we were discussing with the government is PushPakom. You know, the fact that everyone has to use the same provider, maybe that could be liberalized, that you could have different kind of shops that have a license to provide vehicle checkups, maybe overseen by PushPakom, rather than there just being that monopoly in place, which is going to drive people to a very small provider. So, I mean, overall, I think the risk is that, you know, in a number of areas, you have these kind of rather inefficient rules that are basically based on an older set of rules that apply to taxis, that I do think could have the impact of significantly reducing the number of drivers that can be bothered to jump through all those hoops, which will reduce the number of drivers on the road, ultimately driving up prices and reducing choice. And I think the government themselves actually recognize that's probably going to happen, which is why I think it's a shame that we're in this position. And I think the best thing to do now would be to take a pause and try and see if we can't improve those regulations a bit more.
And Lawrence, there is also the Future of Work conference, which was attended by Tony Poor and Khairi Jamaluddin as well. And some of the suggestions that have come out from, for example, Tony Poor, is to strike a balance between the gig economy and hiring of graduates through increased minimum wage and EPF. Do you think that the government could adopt some of this carrot approach to encourage the gig economy?
It's interesting. I mean, I'd have to look in detail at the proposals. I mean, I think the key thing to bear in mind for the gig economy is the flexibility, you know, the fact that people can kind of choose to work the hours they want. So I think the risk is always putting too many controls into it, because that sort of defeats the kind of the underlying benefit that it has. But at the same time, I also recognize that we have this problem with wages, and we've got to start getting quite creative about how we try and generate wage growth across the distribution in Malaysia. So I think in that spirit is definitely something worth considering.
Thank you so much for your time. And that was Lawrence Todd, Head of Research and Development at IDEAS. And moving on, also, in light of global loosening of monetary policy and a more dovish tone, could we see Bank Negara follow suit with another rate cut?
Yeah, so the central bank's review this week will be scrutinized by global funds. And if there's any hint of dovish tilt, it could rekindle interest in Malaysian bonds. Overseas investors sold a net of $650 million of Malaysian bond in the first 5 months this year, and taking foreign holdings of the nation debt to the lowest since 2011.
Yeah, foreign investors have been pumping money into higher yielding Indonesian debt and Thai notes, which Bloomberg reports is a safe haven play. On top of that, slowing exports and tepid inflation have raised expectations that policymakers will need to consider adding to May's quarter point cut at some point in 2019. Now, the last review, and in May, the central bank struck a broadly neutral tone, saying that the 25 basis point reduction to 3% was actually intended to preserve the degree of monetary accommodativeness.
That's right. 21 of the 24 economists surveyed by Bloomberg expect Bank Negara to keep the interest rates unchanged for tomorrow. The decision time is actually tomorrow. And we have Julia Goh, economist at UOB Malaysia Online, to help us dissect this more. Thanks for joining us, Julia. At this juncture, can you just tell us a little bit about what your current economic outlook is?
Good morning. We are cautious as external risks still linger and the domestic economy has slowed. While I think recent Malaysian data does not signal a sharp deceleration in the economy, we think that there are still downside risks. Although US and China have agreed to restart their talks post the G20 meeting, but I think markets are cautious as there is no concrete or comprehensive agreement between the two countries, and we have not seen any tariffs removed. So we are attaching a 30% probability that talks could stall again and further tariffs are announced.
And Julia, what are your monetary policy expectations?
So we correctly predicted that Bank Negara would cut rates in May. We think that Bank Negara will keep rates on hold tomorrow. And our view is that there won't be any more rate cuts, and we expect rates to stay unchanged in the second half, provided that there is no deterioration environment.
And Julia, just asking with regards to your current economic outlook, right? If things continue to deteriorate, what options does Bank Negara actually have?
Well, one of the options, of course, is to lower the statutory reserve requirement if there are signs of further tightness in the domestic liquidity. We have also seen other measures put in place. For instance, recently Bank Negara has actually made some modifications to allow financial institutions to relax the lending guidelines for SMEs, of course, subject to certain conditions. And they are also allowing for the SMEs to apply to reschedule and restructure their existing loans. So I think the whole purpose is to help tie the SMEs through this challenging period.
And Julia, what kind of impact do you think this would have? I mean, we've had to deal with very low inflation rates at the start of this year. Do you think that these financial institutions would actually channel the money out to the SMEs?
I think if these are genuine cases and genuine borrowers who show that, you know, in the past, financially, they were healthy, but it's because of the external environment, because of weaker orders or weaker trade flows, hence they've encountered difficulties, then I think it's quite possible that they would be allowed some flexibility in their loan refinancing.
And Julia, if we look at the in ringgit range, right, it has been between 413 to 420. Do you expect ringgit to stay in this level if, let's say, the Feds continue to cut rates?
I think, yeah, for now, as long as the renminbi stays within, you know, a stable range, it has been, I think the ringgit should be also trading in a similar range-bound movement below 420. However, as I mentioned earlier, that we are attaching a 30% probability to the possibility that things could, you know, the tensions between US and China could re-escalate again. And in that situation, should the renminbi actually weaken significantly, then the ringgit against the dollar will also probably rise alongside the renminbi.
Julia, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Julia Goh, economist with UOB Malaysia. And I guess the government is going to be, at least Bank Negara is going to be on a wait and see approach, right? Because of what's happening externally.
Yeah, it seems that very much our economy is slowing down though. Exports have gone down a little bit. IPI is also weaker. I think those are the data points that Bank Negara will be keeping a very close eye in terms of what they should do in next meetings, yeah, MPOC meetings.
I'm quite excited about the modification of the rules to lend out to the SMEs as well, because the government has kind of come down slightly hard on the banks for not lending out to the property sector. Mm. But if you relax the rules a little bit, perhaps this can nudge the financial institutions to lend out a little bit more. All right, coming up to the 7:30 news and more business after that, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.